session number 9752, reel 5.
Colonel Dillon, Reel 5. I believe overnight there was a rather amusing incident, if you'd like to tell us.
It was rather an amusing incident. It was a dry night with no rain, but in the early morning when we all foregathered shivering round a small fire trying to get a cup of tea, second-in-command of the company arrived and said, "My word, it was cold last night." He said, "It affected my bladder. I'm too cold to stand up." So he said, "I just turned over and let fly where I was." And we thought nothing of this until the company commander came in and said, "It must have been wet last night. I was lying in the furrow next to Jones, second in command. And I woke up, my trousers completely soaked." And we all said, "But there's been no rain." However, he didn't realise what had happened. So that passed off, mercifully. The next night we got our blankets.
What did you do the next day in Vermel?
We hung about, waiting for orders. The battle of Loos had then started. But being pioneers, we were very fortunately at the back of the line, back of the battle. Towards dark, we were marched up with the supporting brigade of troops. And we were ordered to help go forward and dig new trenches behind the German lines where the ground had been gained from the Germans. When we arrived there, past Vermel and into the fighting area, there was a scene of the utmost chaos. Every kind of regiment was mixed up. The people walking about in the dark, not knowing where they were or where their units were. We were still a coherent body at that time, and we didn't know what to do. We had no orders. All those who were capable of giving orders had gone on or got lost. And I was told to go forth, see if I could find the brigade headquarters of the unit doing the attack and get some information. As I was about to do so, a senior officer appeared out of the mist. He seized hold of a young officer who was passing by and said to him, "Here, my boy, here's your chance. Now rally these men together. Get them together. Get at the enemy. You must do something for your country. Now get busy." It never occurred to him that he might have done something himself to get busy. However, he went off into the dark and nobody saw him again. And I made my way to the guards' headquarters, the brigade headquarters. I was easily found because, well-known place, because it had a dead horse outside which stank to heaven, so you had a pinpoint to march on. And there I found discipline, tidiness, everything in order. There was even a white cloth on some ammunition boxes serving as a table, and a bottle of port and glasses on it. And they knew what was happening, and they told me to go away, take your unit away, because we're taking over here and all will be well. And of course it was well, it always is when the guards take hold of anything. So I went away very relieved. One thing I missed Edward VIII, the Prince of Wales, who at that same time must have been in that same place that it's referred to in his memoirs. I managed to find some of my unit. With the help of my compass, I steered my way back to where we'd started from, and the others trickled in together, and we eventually marched back to our starting place in the ploughed field. From there,
had the unit actually achieved anything yet? Had anything been dug or
achieved? Absolutely nothing. It done nothing but Fred Carnot's army marched to and fro and did absolutely nothing. Having got to the mill and settled down there and sorted ourselves out, the division was being pulled out of the line because the guards had taken it over, and it was to be marched and entrained for Belgium. Now, the stupidest thing in the world happened as an example of bureaucratic idiocy. The march table had been made out for the various battalions of the division to march back along a certain road, and that road included the village of Vermel, which was quite sensible for those troops who were fighting in the line. They would gradually be relieved by the guards and form up and march past Vermel and so back into the back country and get entrained. But my unit was already on our side of Vermel, but our orders were to march through Vermel. So my commanding officer protested and said, "This is ridiculous. We have to march a mile up towards the lines, march along the road a little way, and then march back again." He said, "This is ridiculous." "Oh," said the general staff, "you must do it. It's down there on the orders, you must do it." And do it we did. And when we got to Vermel, I noticed a large board on the side of the road with the legend on it as follows: "Do not halt here. This road is shelled regularly at 2:30 p.m. every afternoon." It was then 2:25. And as the column was passing this notice board, sure enough, the Germans shelled it. We lost several men and an officer, and several more wounded. And that was our first experience of shell fire. So with cries from the men of "Get on, move on," we moved on and got back to our ploughed field. And from there, we marched off in the tail of the division and eventually found the train we were supposed to go on.
There's just two points I want to pick up now. That's two incidents where the staff have aroused comments. One, when the gentleman was telling people to rally.
Yes.
And now this, where they insisted on you marching back and through Vermel.
Yes.
Did this arouse... Was there already beginning... a feeling against the staff? Did a feeling against the staff arise at this time?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Commonly, the staff was commonly thought of as being idle. It's a common saying that the soldiers had bread, but the life on the staff was one long loaf. In other words, cynical remarks of that sort. There's no doubt that they are justified. The trouble was that the staff had no knowledge themselves. Where were they going to get it from? They only had the Boer War and the Crimean experiences to draw on. And they were all coloured by the Battle of Waterloo. So you rather must excuse these well-meaning but hopeless people.
The other point is, I believe you had to bury some dead bodies, some of the dead, while you were in the Loos area.
That's the only thing we did in the Loos area. The day after the battle, I was sent up with my platoon to bury some of the dead, and I arrived, it used to be the front line, there in front of the German wire, barbed wire, were rows and rows of men lying down, close together, all pointing the same direction. And my men thought they were sleeping, and went to more than one of them and gave him a kick and said, "Hey, wake up, wake up, you don't want to be sleeping here." And then, of course, they were dead. And we had to get busy and bury them. It wasn't very easy because the Germans were shelling them at that time. And I was very young and inexperienced, and I didn't know whether I had to be brave and walk forth and go on burying the dead in the midst of a rain of shells, or to hold back until the shell fire had finished. Luckily, my doubts resolved themselves and the Germans packed up and stopped, and we got on with our burying. Not a very pleasant job. There were hundreds and hundreds of them, as far as I could see.
Were they mainly... Could you tell what had caused the casualties? Was it small arms or machine gun fire or shrapnel? Or
machine gun fire from the flanks. So the wire was supposed to have been cut by artillery fire, but as we knew later on, it wasn't a practical proposition. It didn't work.
Did it upset you, this job?
No. You know, one's emotions at that time are, as you might say, bottled up in a tin can. You would be far more upset if you'd found somebody injured and mutilated in a street accident than you recognize that this was war and dead people were just part of it. So it never impinged on me in that way, I'm glad to say, although I've known some people who used to feel sick if they saw people who'd been cut about and blown about. It's just a matter of how it takes you. I wasn't a hardened cynic at all. It was simply a matter of, I suppose, use to the situation, like everybody else.
Was your role supervisory in the burying of the dead?
Yes, I didn't do any digging myself with my own hand. There were plenty of men to do it.
Was it a mass grave?
In a sense. Depended where the bodies were lying. If you've got 20 or 30 in the strip, then you dig a strip long enough to take them. It wasn't very deep. My job was to collect their identity discs and their personal wallets and things and put them in a sandbag and label them. So they went off to the base and got back to the relatives.
Right, thank you. So you were, getting back into the chronological thing, you were put in, put on a train and sent up to Belgium. Which part of the, this would be round about October, would we be just into?
Right, October, yes.
Which bit of the Belgian front were you sent to?
Armentières. That's our next port of call.
And what was your role in the Armentières front?
As a platoon commander, I was set to dig trenches, tunnels from the front line underneath the surface. The intention of the authorities was to cut off a salient there, which was annoying them, and they're going to dig trenches from either side of the salient, just a foot out of the surface, and then going to attack over the top and break open the trenches we dug underground like moles, push up the top. They had a ready-made trench to support your attacking troops. Of course, this trench had to be made wavy for the obvious reasons, like all trenches have to, and it wasn't easy if the two sides working from each side to meet together in the middle. However, we hit it off within a couple of feet, which wasn't bad considering the only surveying implement I had was a prismatic compass. But the men took huge delight in this, for they were used to surveying underground in the mines with a plumb bob and a theodolite, and we did it by rather primitive methods with the plumb bob and the prismatic compass. This wasn't a very pleasing occupation. The trench that we dug, the mole hole that we burrowed, was only about a foot below the surface, and it was constantly being broken into by shell fire in no man's land. That's the land between the two trenches, between us and the Germans, about 70 yards. And it meant my going out at night with another chap to help and find these holes and fill them in, because you couldn't fill them in from underneath. From underneath we could put up roofing boards and so on, but we had to go out at night and fill in the holes, otherwise the German patrols would have found them. The difficulty was that not only were there these very lights showing every movement every now and then, but when you'd finish the job and try to get back into your own trench, liable to be shot by our own people. And it didn't matter how much trouble I took to warn the men in the trenches that we were out and coming back again, some trigger-happy person would have a shot. On one occasion they actually had a shot at us as we came in. We were actually on the parapet about to jump down when somebody shot my sergeant in the leg. And the troops were always a bit trigger happy in that respect. Anything in the dark or in the shadow, they lose off at. Never mind what they've been told.
What working methods did you actually employ in digging this mole-like tunnel affair?
We started out from one of the trenches and dug into the side, and was a sort of manhole into the side. About 5 feet height and about 2 feet across, and into that inserted a wooden framework. Then the next thing was to push a little further on and put another wooden framework in front of it, and so on.
About how far between each set of wood would there be?
They were very close together, within a few inches, because the soil was very wet and it had no power of clinging together, so that we had to be very, very careful. We were really digging through mud to a large extent. The water table was very high then, and if you dug down more than a couple of feet, you were in water.
Was the wood on both sides and above, or was it below as well, underneath? So
complete box, both sides, top, bottom, and sides.
And how wide would it be along the tunnel? Each set of wood.
Each set would be about 6 to 8 inches wide.
And then a gap of a few inches, and then another.
Gap of a few inches, and then another one. Some places there'd be no gap at all. Must have used an enormous amount of timber.
Who would bring the timber up? Was that part of the pioneer battalion responsibility?
Yes. We used to carry it up with us every day.
Where would it come from? Was it supplied for you, or would another party be making the timber into the rifle?
We established a kind of workshops in a woolen mill, and had a circular saw set up there, and the timber was prepared there. I don't think from round logs. I think it came in sheets, and it was cut up, and each box had each box was made of the top and bottom had a nick at each side, and each side piece had a pointer at each side, so they slotted together, a sort of dovetail effect. We carried them up, which was quite an onerous thing to do, because it meant about a mile march across Pave Road, and then a quarter of a mile by trench, mainly waterlogged, and then across waterlogged country where there was no protection at all except a canvas screen to prevent observation by the enemy. Unfortunately, one or two of my men got fed up with carrying these planks and threw them down. Probably nobody noticed, but the airplane photograph showed these white planks up very clearly on the way up to the trench. And I think it must have given the Germans a lot of thought, wonder what on earth they were for. It wasn't just sort of example of carelessness, which gives away things to the enemy.
The wood was put in every so often. What was the actual working method for the digging? How many miners would you have in there, or diggers would you have in at a time?
There was only really room for one man to dig at the face of the work. He would dig away as hard as he could, and the man behind him would shovel it back into another man's hands who held the sandbag. They would then, with a series of men, the sandbags would be carried out of the trench and deposited outside.
Where was that mud or dirt or soil eventually put? Because that also would have appeared on observation, wouldn't it? Photographs. Was any effort made to conceal it?
No, because it was used to strengthen the trench defences. You see, the trenches are not dug very deep because of the water, and most of it was built up on top in the shape of sandbags. So you had a sandbag pile all along the front of the trenches, and these sandbags we pulled out of the tunnel merely added to the others and were insignificant to an observer.
The man who was digging, would he use a short-handled pick, or would he use some other digging implement?
In that soft soil, I think we used an entrenching tool, which was resembled a short pick but had a shovel-like effect on one side.
How long would the digger and the shoveler work? Well, it's fairly tiring work, surely. What shifts would they be on?
They'd go on half an hour at a time each. Then they had plenty of relays for people to take their places.
How much progress would you make in a day, complete with putting the wood in?
Probably, I think, 3 or 4 yards. And there was about 75 yards to do, I think.
Within the shift of each of the digger having half an hour, what was your platoon's shift of a day? How was your day organised when you were on this job?
I can't remember. I don't know. Is it strictly relevant?
I just wondered how long you were on the job during the day, would you be there for the whole of the day? Or
I'd be there all during the daylight hours. There were no trades union hours then. We didn't work at night because we'd been so easily spotted by enemy patrols who would have heard, might have come across the noises underground, seeing that they're only a foot beneath the surface. So we were restricted to daylight watching, working.
Where would you be in night? Would you pull back to billets and Armentières?
I always walk back to billets and Armentières.
So you weren't actually based in the lines?
No, we weren't.
While you were at Armentières?
No.
How did this job... Was it a successful mission? Did this attack take place after you dug the tunnel?
Never took place. The tunnel wasn't a very welcome institution amongst the people who had to hold the line, because it was, so to speak, a back door for the enemy to get in. But there was no attack made and it was never used.
What other jobs were you put on then at this time?
There was a tunnelling company working alongside us, and I did a little bit to help them, not very much, more or less as a matter of interest than anything else. They were digging a mine under the Germans, and during the course of the digging, in that very soft mud where you could hear nothing, they holed into a German mine gallery, and it was full of water. Ours had been full of water. It was full of water because pumps were going the whole time, and we could hear the Germans' pump going, trying to keep their mine free of water. But the River Lys runs alongside that particular trench, number 88, and we got a large hose pipe and laid it and siphoned the water out of the River Lys down into the German sap. And they were happily pumping the Lys through the sap for about 3 weeks before they discovered that they were having their legs pulled. That was my first experience of deep mining, which wasn't very much.
What was your role to help in the tunnelling company? You say you mainly helped on the entrances.
No, I'm afraid you got me wrong there.
Sorry.
My role in the tunnelling company at that time was practically nil. Do you mean my role in the tunnelling of the trenches by our own regiment?
Yes.
Not by the tunnelling company. My role was to start in the right place, see that the trench went in the right direction, the mole went in the right direction, and supervise the staying up of the roof, going out at night, seeing if it had been blown in.
Could you just explain this plumb line and prismatic compass method, if it's possible to explain in layman's terms?
It's quite simple. You hold a man holds a piece of white string, chalked string, with a weight on the end, in the middle of the place that they're digging, as you might explain it, a closed doorway. The man holding it stands to one side, and in the middle of this doorway, and then you can take your compass and move to the starting point and take a bearing on the compass on this string and write that down on your map. Next time you do it, you start from where the plumb line is being held with the compass there and put it onto the next step. Suppose you go 20 yards. So you want to see that 20 yards lines up with the bearing you want on your compass. It's pretty simple, really.